Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. In the studio today is Professor Peter Vassallo, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing about his latest project, In Medias Res, or British-Italian Cultural Transactions. Of course, Professor Vassallo is well known to many of our listeners, I'm sure, but I'll just say a little word about his academic life. He started off thinking that, in fact, he might follow a legal career, but early on, after a felicitous meeting with Professor Beck, he realised that English was really his métier. After graduating here in Malta, he went to Oxford to continue his studies and gained his MA and DPhil there in 1978. After teaching at the sixth form of the Lyceum and at Junior College in Valletta, Professor Vassallo joined the University of Malta and was head of Department of English for many years. His main research interest is Byron, and he's considered a world expert on this poet, whose life straddled the 18th and 19th centuries, and who has, of course, connections with Malta, which I presume we're going to hear about. Professor Vassallo was instrumental in the setting up of the Institute for Anglo-Italian Studies here at the University, and is editor of the Journal of Anglo-Italian Studies, which is a publication with many international contributors who attend conferences held regularly here in Malta. Welcome, Professor Vassallo.
Thank you.
Professor, I lived for 20 years in the UK, and I must say, I never heard Italian spoken once. It was all French and France, and that was really it. While, of course, any educated British person would have immediately recognised the main Italian landmarks and would have known, of course, that Italy was the custodian of a large part of the world's cultural artefacts, I cannot say that there was, at that time, much contact with Italy in general. Of course, I know that it was not always thus.
I think English people nowadays don't speak Italian as they did in the past, but a lot of them do go to Italy for the holidays, and some of them have the rich, as I would have thought, the aristocratic sphere we're now dealing with, have places in Florence, houses in Florence and in Fiesole and San Gimignano. But of course, you don't expect English people really to speak other languages, I would have thought.
No.
Because English is a worldwide language, and they just get by just using English. But when they go over, I know friends of mine who are academics go over and they speak very good English, of course, sometimes with a very English accent, but nonetheless very correct English.
What about the points in history? I mean, when you look back and across the years, at what points were there, in actual fact, very close contacts between Italy and England?
Well, it's a long history of close cultural contact. I think the point of contact was Italy, Italian literature and culture in the Renaissance. I think that is the first, our starting point, really. Italian, in all things Italian, were looked upon as novel, the fashion of the time. Again, people, the courtiers and people in high society were acquainted with Castiglione's Libro del Cortegiano, which was translated into English and was very popular. It was a manual of courtly behaviour coming from Italy. There were two sides to the Italian influence. One was literary and cultural, of course, Dante in particular, Ariosto, Tasso, Gerusalemme Liberata was translated by Fairfax. And there was an influence there on literature, on the epic, and of course the sonnet, the sonneteering. Wyatt and Surrey got inspiration directly from Petrarch and Petrarch's Canzoniere. And the idea of the woman and who is aloof and the sense of unrequited love. That is one aspect. The other aspect, of course, Italy was the land of lurid melodrama and intrigue and politics. And this is the impression of the English scholars and literary people got from reading Machiavelli's Principe. Even Shakespeare sets the murderous Machiavel to school in Richard III. So there's the other side, there's the flip side of that.
They were a bit ambivalent,
ambivalent
about the relationship.
There was the attraction of Italy and things Italian. On the other hand, there was this sense of political intrigue and the end justifying the means and also villainy. Most of the villains are Machiavellian, in fact.
And towards the end of that Renaissance period, certainly England would have looked slightly askance as the Protestant Revolution sort of took hold, the religious changes in Britain took hold. They would have started to look at Italy in a slightly different light.
Well, Italy still was an attraction, and later on, I mean, during a century and a half later, and even more, in the late 17th century, you've got this interest in going to Italy again and the beginnings of the Grand Tour. And Italy was, of course, the place of art and monuments. They didn't go to Greece because Greece was under Turkish rule and it was not safe to go there. But Italy was a sort of substitute, a surrogate. And they went there, and they were, you know, Richard Lascelles wrote his guidebook for his Vademecum for young, wealthy gentlemen who wanted to further their education abroad. And of course, listing the monuments, of Italy they had to visit. And, of course, listing also the dangers. And of course you had the dangers of what they considered to be the dangers of the Catholic Church of eventually became popery. And popery was, of course, the machinations of these Machiavellian popes who were there for power and because they were placed there because of the financial interest, not of the spiritual interest as well. So that it became an attraction again, but was the danger that it had this pernicious charm.
And mm-hmm. what really attracted the Romantic poets to Italy? I mean, okay, they would have been interested, like everyone else, to visit the beautiful places, but there must have been sort of something else that was sort of pulling them towards Italy, since they all seem to have ended up there.
Yes, true. Well, in different ways. Byron, as you know, ended up in Venice. Venice was the city of frivolity for him. He was in his ambiance, as it were, and he had his amorous relationships with a number of Venetian women. Shelley was fascinated by Italy, by the Rome's ruins, and also by the Italian way of life. But I think that underlying all this, there's a strong influence of Dante. Because Dante was translated by Henry Carey, and Coleridge had given lectures on Dante in London, recognizing this Italian poet's great genius and comparing him with Milton. So there was a great interest in Dante as a literary progenitor. And, of course, poets started writing in the manner of Dante. Shelley, for example, started imitating Dante's Terza Rima. And he translated a passage from the Purgatorio, which is the Matilda gathering flowers and singing, the lovely passage there, which reminded him of the mythical Proserpina who was abducted while gathering flowers in Sicily. Byron also translated into a Tavarima. He translated part of Dante, the most romantic part of all, which is the Francesca and Tarimini episode, which he felt was very moving. Of course, Byron, as usual, tried to cover this up by calling it My Fanny of Rimini, anglicising it.
I remember going to what they refer to as Keats' house in Rome, in the Piazza di Spagna, thinking to myself how strange it was that we should be standing in the middle of Rome in this quintessentially Italian situation, both architecturally and atmospherically. And there you had the memory of a poet that was quintessentially an English poet. And it was a lovely sort of juxtaposition. The atmosphere there was particularly interesting.
Yes, well, it still is, because when you go there, I go there regularly because they have a splendid romantic library there upstairs, and you go to the place where Keats actually, you're shown the room where he died, where the bed was, where Severn made the drawing of him as he lay dying. Severn was his faithful friend and artist friend who felt he had to be with him to the very end. Keats went there not for cultural reasons, really, but because he was going to die. He knew he was very ill, and the doctors told him that an English winter would have been fatal for him, so he had to go to the warm south, and Severn volunteered to accompany him, and it was there that he died. And we have, of course, a very graphic account of his last moments, almost gasped and coughed by a cough. It's horrible to read, but at the same time you see what the poor man went through at the age of 26.
I remember looking at the exhibition they have there of some of his manuscripts and being fascinated by the bits that got crossed out.
Oh, yes.
And when you look at them and you say to yourself, gosh.
This is what scholars like doing, the scholarly editions, well, the Variorium editions, scholarship. And they show you why, probably giving you reasons why the phrases were crossed off.
Yeah. Before carrying on to talk about perhaps the In Medias Res project itself, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm speaking to Professor Peter Vassallo about Italy and England. And relationships between the two countries. Whose brainchild, in fact, was this In Medias Res project?
It all started when a group of English scholars, professors, met. One was from Edinburgh, another from Leicester, and they thought of having a sort of a cross-cultural basis for research, English literature and beyond. And they did apply to the British Academy, and the British Academy approved and decided to sponsor this project, which involves the four founding universities, the British scholar, an Italian scholar, Carlo Dente from Pisa, the British scholar is Martin Stannard, who is the head of department at English department at Leicester, and Professor Manfred Pfister, who's written an excellent book on Anglo-Italian relations called The Fatal Gift of Beauty. He's from the University of Berlin, the Free University of Berlin, and Professor Stephen Rowley from Nanterre University in Paris. And so you've got these four universities, having this joint project approved by the British Academy, and of course they have colloquia once a year. And the last one was in Pisa, which I was invited to go to, and of course I think they did in fact realize that since I was into this on the literary side, on the Anglo-Italian side, they felt that they wanted me to be on the advisory board, which for me was an honour, I think.
And what actually does the project aim to achieve? What are its goals, really?
I think that whole idea is within the framework now of kind of a common European cultural core. It's going beyond Britain to influences outside Britain and British influence on, say, Italy. It is British-Italian cultural transaction because it would be too wide otherwise, too vast. And we focused on literature mainly, art. There's Professor Yarrington, who is an expert on Italian art and its influence on British art. For example, she spoke on a colloquium on that. And history, a little bit of England, Protestant England in Rome in the time of the Stuarts, and so on. And I think this broadens the area of research because, of course, I think you have to do this when you're dealing with literature. You just can't keep on writing about the same authors all the time. You have to go beyond that into a kind of comparative literary and cultural study.
Well, certainly if you look at the area of architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. You have we had Alison Yankton also spoke, I think, on Palladio and the influence of Palladio in England. That's already is quite an achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And in fact, I was looking at some of the titles. You mentioned the Stuart Court in Rome, which is always a subject that has sort of interested me over the years. Yeah. I don't know, did you actually listen to that paper?
Yes, it's a very interesting paper, a bit technical and details from diaries, but it was the way the Protestant England had a little sort of enclave there, and the way they had to be wary of the possibility of contamination by the Roman Catholics.
Absolutely, I think that the going back to sort of the Bonnie Prince Charlie story, it's sort of very romantically portrayed from on the British side, but I think his end in Rome was not as romantic.
No, not all that romantic. No. There were some unsavoury details,
which I think people who are keen on Bonnie Prince Charlie tend to gloss over.
Well, of course, historians tend to do. And in my history book, she was a hero. Of course.
Yes, absolutely. Also, another one of the papers from the 2007 symposium, which took place at University of Leicester, was refugees in the 1930s. So we're actually sort of moving along the historical spectrum here and
yes,
including
it was
more
about
contemporary
refugees and exiles and refugees and the way refugees were treated in the country as they moved from country of origin to the new adopted country. And there were refugees, pocket of Italian refugees in Scotland, for example.
Many
in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And I myself spoke on the earlier period, which is Gabriele Rossetti, and his fleeing to Malta because he was under sentence of death for his part in the revolution against Ferdinand II of Naples, and the way he was treated here, and he was befriended by hook and frere. It was that relationship, and then of course he goes to London eventually, after 3 years of staying in Malta, and he lives there with a group of Italian refugees who form a kind of enclave there, literary enclave, translating the text, the main literary canonical text. Mm. And of course, then Cristina Rossetti comes into, and Dante Gabriele, because they keep up this Anglo-Italian influence.
Now, with the In Medias Res project, where are you moving on? What is the next step?
Well, I just now finished a section on Yeats, the poet, for a new Cambridge History of English Poetry, which is edited by Michael O'Neill. I was invited to do the Yeats section, and especially on Yeats and Castiglione, the influence of the Italian Renaissance on Yeats's poetry, because he was hoping to do for Ireland what the Italians had done in their own time during the Renaissance by sort of enlisting aristocratic patronage, of course, like people like Lady Gregory, etc. I've done that. And now I'm involved, very involved, with the International Association of University Professors of English. And I'm expected to, well, I was elected president of the association, which has about 520 full professors, members from all over the world, the United States, Canada, Australia, all Britain, or most of Europe, including Italy, Spain, France, etc. And well, when I was elected president in August of 2007, one of my duties was to convene the triennial conference here in Malta in 2010, which is next year. So I'm busy
creeping
preparing.
Up on you.
Yes, creeping. Yes, right. And then during that conference, they should elect my successor, as it were, because I have a 3-year period as president, and then my successor will be elected then.
How many people would you expect to see at this conference?
I think, well, conservative estimate would be about at least 250. I imagine much more. Of course, now there are other factors. There's the recession and so on. But even so, I think that a lot will come. I think Malta and the Mediterranean will attract a lot of scholars, really.
Yes, I think as a conference centre, as a conference venue, Malta does definitely have its attractions. Unfortunately, with the sterling being almost at par with the euro at the moment, this might create a few problems.
Yeah, but that is unfortunate. But
it may not remain like that for them.
There are certain unforeseeable and unpredictable situations.
And in a meeting like this of your association, presumably what you would be discussing in the papers that would be come up would not. Only be about literary subjects, but about the study of English in general.
Definitely. In fact, well, it's quite interesting because the range is very wide. The scope is from Anglo-Saxon, Beowulf, and all the way up to Chaucer, to Shakespeare, to Pope and Dryden, to the Romantics, to the Victorian, and I've appointed some experts in the field who are, in fact, well-known, whose books are well-known. They are established professors, very distinguished, and they are chairs. They act as issue a kind of call for papers in their own field. And then we put them all together eventually, and it becomes a conference with about 4 or 5, or perhaps 6 parallel sessions, which you have to have. And then one of the main items for discussion is, of course, the role of English in university.
And yes, because you're full professors, as you said, so that's the level discussed. We're talking about.
Yes, that is always discussed. It's a general, it's a plenary session. I've also invited 2 leading British academics. One is, you probably know of her, Professor Dame Gillian Beer, who was a professor at Cambridge. She's very well known. She's a highly respected and very distinguished scholar. She's said she would be glad to come. And another is Professor John Carey, who's a professor of English at Merton College, Oxford. So I think we have a good team, as it were.
Absolutely. And you would also be talking about trends in...
And seeing the way... Yes, you're looking into the future as well. The situation now, English in universities at the moment, and the way things are going. Mm-hmm. Of course, we'll have to look at the thorny issue of, it's the biggest problem of all, whether to leave the universities in the old sort of sphere of culture for its own sake, or going back to the utilitarian programs of some very modern universities who think in terms of what the country needs at a particular moment. And of course, that will come up, I'm sure. It always does.
And do you think that this utilitarian approach is becoming a major trend, or do you think there is still a lot of resistance to it?
No, I think in Britain it's becoming, after Thatcherism, I think it's become a major trend. Unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate for some universities that they were compelled to realign and to refashion, retailor the courses to make them very sort of functional. And something's lost when that's done. Something, you know, which... Because if you argue about functionality, I think the difficulty there is if you question the need, then as Shakespeare says, even the beggar has more than he needs.
I suppose people are looking at job opportunities, and perhaps an English degree in the sort of old mode, so to speak, is perhaps not looked upon as producing the sort of job opportunities.
I don't wish to give the impression that it's just the old mode, which was available when I was a student. No, I mean, I think if you take our English department at university, we've got a very fine mixture of both of them. You've got the canonical courses. You've got your Shakespearean tragedy, for example, but you've also got quite a long list of courses in linguistics, social linguistics, psycholinguistics, phonetics, and now in translation as well, and theory of translation, and so on. So I think we've moved into that sphere too, which gives you a nice balance between the old sort of system, let's say the Newman system, which prevailed for so long, and the utilitarian program, which will enable students to get jobs after all.
We just have a minute left to talk about something which I know is very close to your heart, the Journal of Anglo-Italian Studies. I think we will shortly be seeing a new edition.
Yes, there's a new edition coming out, which will contain most of the papers at the conference we organised. When I say we, it is myself, Professor Gloria Lauri-Lucenta, and with a lot of help from the International Office and from FIS, Lucien Bajaya, and especially Patricia Lumicalle, who's also editing this volume under my general editorship, because I will be contributing a paper too on Forster, Ian Forster, and the pernicious charm of Italy, in fact.
Well, we look forward to seeing this new edition. I'd like to thank you very much, Professor Peter Massallo, for coming to talk to us
today. Thank you very much.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.